Theater Festival in the Midwest, I didn't really know him, and only have a vague notion as to what he looks like. I think the only picture I've ever seen of him is the one on Wikipedia, and I think he does not look exactly like that, or he did not look exactly like that as he aged, and so forth and so on, as some of us do. I'm sure people who knew me when I had hair probably would never recognize me in passing today. So, I don't know. We'll see. Because I know there's probably going to be a contingent of people from Chicago Classic Computing there tomorrow. So I may go. Depends. It's a little tricky transportation-wise, so we'll see what happens. Pizza Pal's commenting that, I guess he's commenting about the Build Blinky project, and he's commented that he soldered a few pins. They may have been a little more difficult, simply because, you know, modern component leads and solder tend to be lead free, and temperature has to be a little higher on, and soldering iron to get things to melt and bond correctly, and then the higher you run the iron temperature wise, the less time you can keep it in contact with the circuit board, depending upon the quality of the board and how good the solder mask is, without potentially damaging it. But, you know, it just takes some practice, and it requires you to get into a little bit of rhythm when doing a lot of soldering. It's not particularly hard. It's just, you know, requires a little bit of practice. Getting high on the fumes, it's Publius. Yes, those lead fumes, right? Those imaginary lead fumes, yeah. Yeah, that's not the problem. The burning rosin is the problem. Because that does outgas. But of course, when people who do not know talk about fumes during soldering, you know, they always talk about lead fumes. It's like, you're not getting the lead alloy hot enough to vaporize. But for me, usually the rosin core solder, if I accidentally breathe in some of the smoke from that accidentally, usually it triggers an asthma attack almost instantly for me. So I try not to do that. Probably should invest in a capture filter at some point, but I don't really do that much soldering work these days. I suspect if I was doing more, I would probably invest in that. Or if it's a fair day, I could always sit outside and do it.
There are three other parties in this conference.
Hello, other party.
Oh, hey, Jasmine, this is Pizza Pal.
Hey, Pizza Pal, how have you been?
Open VoIP
929-1269. Oh, you still there? Or you're trying to fucks with your audio so it doesn't recapture the audio output into your microphone. Lost him. He's probably futzing with his audio.
There are three other parties in this conference.
Hello, hello. I can hear you distantly repeating, or I should say myself distantly repeating.
Where's the feedback coming from?
I know. Yeah, sometimes if you're like doing it on a laptop, sometimes if you have the audio turned, you know, the audio output turned up too high and the gain on the microphone input up too high, it will, you know, your audio out will be caught on your input. I have that problem sometimes since I like to use old iMacs for video conferencing, so I got to be careful about that. Or the other trick is to just, you know, pop headphones in, and that way you don't have the problem unless, you know, your head is cavernous and is a good resonator. Yeah, it could be your monitor, could be a lot of things. Hi, JWH, and just said hello in combo chat. What else is going on? Other than the American Thanksgiving holiday and World of T-Pug happens. World of Commodore hosted by T-Pug happens after that. What is it? On the November 30th and December 1st, I believe, over that weekend, which is a little inconvenient for us U.S. people if we wanted to attend. But it's not really a problem for me this year. I don't really have the time to make it out there this year. I'm hoping I'll be able to attend next year. And sometimes they will do the content online. I think usually they have a Zoom room or something, and then release the content either stream it live to the YouTube channel or release it after. I don't recall. I think they've been releasing after to kind of promote people to contribute a little money to participate in the Zoom side of the event live. And Rusty One says he solders like old people drive, slowly and extremely slowly and extra carefully. Or do you do it like Mr. Magoo, where nothing looks like anything and you go anywhere and everywhere?
Open VoIP 929-299-1269.
Over the road? Question mark. Yeah, I usually try to take my time, except, of course, once again, you got to kind of be a little careful about how much heat and how much time you're applying heat to the particular solder pad, so you don't accidentally char it or lift it. Pizza Pal also comments that soldering to him is like painting, like loading the brush. A little bit, I guess. You know, you have to keep the tip tinned and cleaned. But it's not like, not like you have to constantly reload it. You're kind of just moving along, feeding solder into the joint. Although I guess if you're doing, high density, you know, tight pitch, surface mount components, then it's kind of a little wilder. You have to kind of, if you're doing it by hand, you kind of have to learn to use ample liquid flux and allow that and the solder mask to kind of keep the solder bridging from occurring while you kind of zipper across it. Not my, tight pitch surface mount components, doing them by hand is not my favorite work. Pizza Bell says, I like how Mr. Bean drives on an easy chair that he can't fit in his little tiny car, so he straps it to the roof and extends the controls with broomsticks and such. Drives the vehicle from the easy chair strapped to the roof of the car. Yeah, Pizza Palace, I got the high-density ones, like one ICs that look like they have tiny little things coming out. Yeah, well, I mean, they are surface mount components. They were really designed to be handled by a pick-and-place machine, and soldered by someone, Essentially, a die is placed over the board, and solder paste is applied by a type of squeegee, and then the pick-and-place machine puts down the components, and it goes through an oven that has sort of preheat and cooling zones in it to sort of more evenly ramp up the heat to the point where the solder paste sort of does its thing, you know, outgasses the flux that is embedded in the material so that it pushes out as much oxygen as possible and attempt to make a sort of lasting metallic joint between the component lead and the circuit board by way of the solder. But I've noticed something with the lead-free solder seems to tarnish a little easier, it seems to me, over time, especially if the environment is not particularly great for it. I had a couple of hard drives I had to pump the other year, and that was sort of the failure mode on them, that board to connector for the motor interfaces or a sort of interference FET or pressure FET, and sometimes you can get lucky, and if it's a controller board failure, you can swap them out. But I had noticed when I had pulled one of the controller boards off of the failed drive that the so-called tin contacts on both the pins and the mother and the circuit board in particular were pretty seriously tarnished, and I was able to clean up a couple of them, get the data back. Sometimes you get lucky. I think we had one that was, you know, actually an electromechanical failure, something failed internally. But, surface mount soldering technology is really intended to be sort of placed by machines rather than hand soldered. But, you know, people do it. I know people that rework boards frequently. I know a few people that, you know, that is, they're electronic technicians. And, you know, they'll get sample boards, and they will not be stuffed by a pick-and-place machine, and they will build up prototypes themselves and do the testing. In order to shake out any possible problems before they do a full production run. Chatting with some people over the last couple of weeks on Quantum Link Reloaded, someone had mentioned that I guess there is a guy who has sort of reverse engineered and reproduced the CMD FD series floppy drives. I'm sure some people would like that. I have mixed feelings on reproducing that stuff, especially if you're doing it. You know, if you're not taking advantage of modern components, because, you know, probably costs more to manufacture it today in small volume than the original drives cost. It might even be more expensive than what you would get on eBay for an original drive. I don't know. I haven't priced that stuff, but I guess if you want an extended density floppy for your Commodore 8-bit machine, and since there are a very limited amount of working CMD FD40 drives still in the wild, that is one route to go. And then I guess there are people re-implementing the RTC, the real-time clock modules, for them as well, which is interesting because the hard drive product came with a real-time clock. The floppies, it was an optional add-on, which is kind of weird. I guess the idea being that if you wanted the RTC, you would either buy the Premier. They probably sold more hard drives than they did floppies, and you know, it made sense to put the RTCs in those, and it didn't make sense to put them in all devices. And also they did the other interesting thing of putting RTC modules in the input devices, the mice, and the trackball controllers that they had made too, which was an interesting choice. And you might say, well, why do you need an RTC module for Commodore 8-bit machine storage? And then the reason being that their file systems supported primitive time stamping of files and directories, so somewhat beneficial. And also, also GEOS, the graphical operating system for the Commodore 8-bit line, Machine C64-128, and to a lesser degree, the Plus 4, you know, supported timestamping of files. So it became kind of beneficial to have at least a single RTC module in one of your peripherals, usually, like I said, usually the hard drive. If you were using floppy drives, the cheap alternative was, or say the cheaper alternative was to get one of the mice or trackballs, which had the RTC built into them, and then it would, you know, timestamp your regular floppy drive files. Or I should say it would set the system clock in the operating system, and then it would timestamp them. The original Commodore DOS on the original drives didn't really support timestamping. But that looks like a bit of a weird thing, because I think they're using a an analog device's CMOS RTC clock and CMOS memory to do that. And it sort of uses, like, I think a CR2032 for the power source on it, so it's kind of got this weird earlobe hanging off of the device because of that. I was wondering if maybe it might have been a smarter thing to just use a supercapacitor to store a charge and just live with the fact that if you're going to put the disk on the shelf for, you know, a year or more, you might have to actually reset the time on it. I know the RTC modules with PRAM, programmable read-only memory, random access memory, was battery, essentially non-volatile battery-backed CMOS RAM in some of the RTC modules that were used in some of the Sun workstations, and those are kind of hard to obtain these days and difficult to get the systems to boot without them. Nakai, is it MPC-3000? Yeah, I'm not familiar with that machine. Floppy drive replaced with a zip drive. And then he says, it wasn't just a zip drive, it was actually a VGA port. Yeah, I don't know enough about those machines to understand exactly what they were doing. I mean, you can stick a zip drive in anything. 929-299-1269. I know that was a popular upgrade for Apple Macintoshes. I think some of the models, actually, you could buy them with zip drives from the factory, you know, from Apple, already installed after a certain point. Now people are just getting weird in combo chat, which is a common enough occurrence. Yeah, so I guess it looks like Scuzzy's troubleshooting will be in the cards for the weekend, so we'll see how that goes. And I guess other than that, this has been OpenVOIP on and on radio.net. Every night it's from 0200 to 0300 hours UTC. And then again, what is it? I always have to think about this because it's not every night, not every afternoon in my case. It is Monday through Saturday at, right, thinking that it's 1800 hours UTC. Where you can basically dial in and talk about whatever you like. And once again, the number to call is 929-299-1269. Visit the tutorial section at sdf.org for more details about the telephone system at SDF. And occasionally, Friday nights will be Vintage Comp with me, Jazz Mass. But I don't know, I just haven't had much time and force of will to do that as of late. I'd like to return to it, but I haven't really been doing much Vintage Comp stuff other than managing stuff, you know, managing a collection of things. And at some point, hopefully, I will get caught up on things in real life and work and other stuff that is a little higher priority than the vintage computing stuff, hobby, and maybe have a little more time for it in the coming months. But, oh well, we shall see. Well, I think we are just about out of time, so this is Jazz Maz. Have a good night and a good weekend if I don't happen to call in the near future. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Open VoIP. Now you can be the DJ with SDF Open Mic. Get on the mic, get on the mic, yo, 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 check it. Get on that mic. You are the DJ.